thing. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. We welcome your calls ordinarily from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here on the Central Coast of California, at 464-8295. Now, for those of you who are regular listeners to Radio Liberty, you recall that every Wednesday evening, why Freedom 21 Santa Cruz did the program, and I got the evening off. But they're going to be doing something else. They're not going to leave the battle. They're going to be trying to have a different influence, so they're giving up radio. So I'm going to be doing the program, and at least right now we're planning on our Wednesday evening program. The first hour will be open lines, but this evening, well, I've been enjoying the writings of a gentleman named Carl Tycribb. Carl Tycribb, and really for some time, but I've never been able to get him onto one of our programs. Well, I have him on tonight. He was in a debate I was involved in this morning, and I really want you to hear what he has to say about the spiritual forces which are behind the geopolitical forces that we talk about all the time. Now, most people know that something's wrong. They know something's happening to our culture. They see America changing. They see the war in the Middle East. They know that we're in financial problems. They've recognized the problems inherent with immigration. They see the breakdown of the moral structure of our society, almost as if there's an organized effort to destroy Christian belief and values. But how do you begin to correlate all this? How do you make any sense out of what goes on as time and time again, why America seems to be helping the very enemies of freedom, as we saw after the First World War, when America helped to establish communism in Russia, and after the Second World War, turning Eastern Europe and China over to the communists, and then fighting a no-win war in Korea and a no-win war in Vietnam, and now really being involved in a no-win war in Iraq because our troops are going to stay there indefinitely. How do you make any sense out of it? Well, Carl, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
I'm glad we could finally make this connection. I'm looking forward to this, and it was an enjoyable time this morning just being in the debate with you and hammering through about an hour's worth of material, and now this chance to spend a little bit of time talking about these very, very important issues that, for the most part, we in North America are wholly ignorant of.
Well, of course, that's why I want you to come on, because I know you've done a great deal of research into the spiritual forces behind the geopolitical forces which we face. So pick up the ball and run with it.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I think one of the things people need to understand right off the bat is that we're looking at something that isn't accidental. When we're talking about how our world is fundamentally changing, so often we'll put our focus on economics or on politics, but rarely do we recognize that behind it all there is a spiritual connection, a spiritual pressure or a force that is changing and molding and shaping our societies. There's a gentleman by the name of Arthur C. Clarke, and he was a science fiction writer, but he was actually a very renowned scientist and very involved in major scientific work, especially regarding radar, satellite trajectories, and so forth.
I'm going to have to ask you to just hold your thoughts there for a minute.
Sure.
As we begin to prepare to go to our first break with our guest this evening, Carl Tycribb, and we're going to be talking about spirituality. Go ahead there, Carl.
Hey, not a problem at all. Is this being taped live? Or?
No, this is actually being taped. Of course, it's also a live program.
Okay.
And, of course, what we're saying now will be going out on the Internet during the break here. And it'll be available, of course, archived in MP3 and available live And then when we come back in about 2.5 minutes, we'll pick up with all of our stations. But you go ahead and we'll work it out, because I don't want to break your train of thought. You're talking about this gentleman who is a science fiction writer, and yet, of course, he really was a scientist who was well aware of the real scientific things going on in the world.
Absolutely. Arthur C. Clarke is a very interesting character. In his book, Childhood's End, which was written in the 1950s, he made a profound statement. And of course, you can oftentimes couch true statements and profound implications in fiction. And sometimes you can get a message across in fiction that wouldn't be well received if it was put out as fact. And this was a very, very interesting statement. He made this, quote, 50 years is ample time in which to change a world and its people almost beyond recognition. All that is required for the task are a sound knowledge of social engineering, a clear sight of the intended goal, and power. End quote. And I thought to myself when I read that, wow, that says it right there. What we're seeing here in terms of global spirituality is a social engineering, and it is linked, connected tightly in with political agendas, with economic agendas, and certainly, with environmental agendas. And that's something that most folks just don't understand, that this is not just a physical battle, but this is, we're dealing in terms of spirituality and the reconstruction of our various social values and our beliefs. The Club of Rome, just to give you a little bit of background, in one of their earlier background papers to goals in the global community, They wrote, the task is therefore to shift humanity's sights onto a higher plane. In a few words, it is to inspire among mankind a conscious global spirit. Well, then the question obviously is, what is that global spirit? What is the social change that we're talking about? And over the last number of years, I've been very fortunate, Dr. Monteith, to go to a number of different United Nations events and different forums. And before I went to these different events and forums, the concept of spirituality I knew was there. I'd read it in the documents. I'd seen it in the different papers and presentations that would sometimes come out on the Internet or in different reports.
And you're going to have to hold that thought. We're going to bring our stations all back on right now. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Carl Tykrib, and he was just talking about a Mr. Clark, Arthur G. Clark, who had written many years ago that you could, with enough time, in 50 years, you could reconstruct society. And then he was talking about this idea put forward by the Club of Rome many years ago that they wanted to build a conscious global outlook on things, or a conscious global spirit. In other words, they wanted to change the spirit, the whole outlook of the population of the world, so that we would think globally instead of locally. And then, of course, Carl was commenting that he's been to so many of the United Nations meetings. And he always knew that there was a spiritual component to what was going on, and pick up the story there.
Oh, certainly. I knew, even before going to these meetings, that there was a spiritual dimension. However, it's one thing to read about it and to examine their reports and to pick it out of their reports. It's another thing entirely to attend and to watch it in play. And this is something that struck me as I was involved in various world affairs conferences and United Nations conferences, seeing this interplay between spirituality and politics, politics and religion, the two topics that nobody seems to want to talk about, at least in any depth. But the issue was, it wasn't about religion in the classical sense of the word, where we're delving into God's word, we're looking into the Bible or anything to that extent. Rather, it was antagonistic towards Christianity, outright hostile on many occasions, and it always centered around esoteric or occultic philosophies. It certainly centered around the philosophy of universalism, the idea that God is whatever you may make him to be. You could have Christ, you could have Buddha, you could have Muhammad, it could even be you. And all this taken together represents the idea of a deity or a god. In Freemasonry, it was described in, within the various Freemasonic literature as the Brotherhood of God and the pardon me, the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. And on a couple of different occasions, I'd even hear that terminology being brought up. What we're doing is striving for the fatherhood of God. In other words, all religions are fundamentally equal, and the brotherhood of man, whereas we can come together in global solidarity, and somehow we're all one world underneath one massive religious umbrella. And when you start seeing this on a first-hand basis, it really hits home just how serious the spiritual implications of this all really are. It's not new. None of this is new, but it is making a profound impact on how our society is now being looked at, being changed.
And, of course, this is what most people don't understand. It all has to do with creating a world government, a world society, but along with that, of course, is the destruction of Christianity as we know it, and we will all merge together into this common religion. You can believe in Christ, but you can't believe that Christianity is the only way. You can believe that Jesus Christ was the Messiah, but then, after all, the Mahdi was a Messiah too, and Maitreya was a society, and the Jewish deity, their Messiah is so they're all equal. No religion is any better than any others, but we're all joined together with this common desire to create a new world order. And, of course, really do away with existing society and supplant it with this new society, which will be based upon this new spirituality. And as crazy it may seem, there really are people who are dedicated to accomplishing that goal. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely. In fact, Dr. Monteith, I just finished attending the United Nations, the Habitat World Urban Forum, the third one. It took place just in Vancouver here last week. And for the first time on the UN Habitat agenda, spirituality was firmly put in place. And so we had a spirituality roundtable where we had leaders from the United Religions Initiative. We had other religious figureheads. We had people from various seminaries. And I went to the roundtable thinking that it would probably be a small group, and not expecting that there would be any kind of real numbers that would attend this obvious, strange mix of politics and religion. And yet when I got to the room, it was really, really full. And I was quite surprised by how many were in attendance and how many were really excited about this idea that, well, we need to incorporate spirituality in our urban development. When we build cities and when we build our communities, we have to have this global spirituality at the center, where cities, where the town squares, where our seats of civic government recognize the essential religious truths, where they come together and say, okay, all religions are commonly equal and proclaim the same universal ideas of love and tolerance and so on and so on. And after 3 hours of this, I felt sick to my stomach, because it was evident that this was nothing more than a rehash of pagan spirituality, where Christians, so-called Christians, where members of the Islamic community, where members of the New Age, the Buddhist, the Wiccan community, could all come together and say, we all are essentially the same. But you know, that raises a real problem. That raises a serious problem. I'll relate a brief story. I was at a major interfaith event in St. Petersburg, Florida, a number of years ago. And it's amazing what you hear at the lectern. Lots of flowery speeches, but not a lot of substance. What you hear around the coffee table, however, is different. Around the coffee table, people really start to share and to come across, let's network, let's really talk this thing through. Somebody raised a good point, and I was amazed that somebody had a logical thought in their head, because so often this is an illogical situation. Somebody all of a sudden had this brainwave, if all religions are equal, what do we do about cults of death? What do we do about Satanism? What do we do about Nazism or neo-Nazism? After all, National Socialism in the German Nazi movement had a messianic figure. It had a doctrine. It had a metaphysics. It had dogma. It had its own scripture, Mein Kampf. How now do we treat these obviously unacceptable social religions? how do we treat them within an interfaith perspective where the bottom line is all religions are fundamentally equal? And of course, everybody around the coffee table was silent. I was just giggling inside, Dr. Monty. It was funny. How can you keep a straight face when all of a sudden you realize that all these interfaith leaders have just run into the same brick wall all at once? And they're stopped, and they looked around, and you could just tell the whole place was just uncomfortable. Finally, when logic all of a sudden takes over and you get to feel uncomfortable, what do? You just change the subject, and all of a sudden the atmosphere is diffused, and away they went off with their little utopian dreams of universal religious, kind of creating this universal religious faith. And I thought to myself, just for a moment, you folks saw, just for a split second, you folks saw the illogical position of the interfaith movement. Obviously, not all religions are fundamentally the same.
And of course, you know, when you get into this, get into this idea of absolutes. Are there absolutes? You know, is there a right? Is there a wrong? And if there is, who will determine what's right and wrong?
Mm-hmm.
And I love the idea. One of the lines of Rabbi Zacharias, who arguing with a man who said, "There are no absolutes. There's no right or wrong. What's right for you is wrong for me. What's right for me is wrong for you." You know, there are no absolutes, and Robbie's reply was, well, you know, some people, for instance, think that, we should all love our neighbors, and other people want to eat their neighbors. Which do you prefer? And, of course, this is really the thing. There has to be something that is greater than we are, and that has to be the God of the universe. And, you know, you can't sort of make up your own God. There is a God that created the heavens and the earth, and he doesn't fit into all the religious beliefs. And that is why there is such an intense conspiracy against Christianity today. That's why they've taken mention of Jesus Christ and God out of our schools and prayer out of our schools and the Christmas story out of Christmas and the Easter story out of Easter, and why they want to remove any religious replicas from our hills, crosses. They've taken all the crosses out of Arlington Cemetery in Washington, D.C. There's an intense hatred of Christianity. When you understand that, you can really begin to understand what's going on in America today.
Certainly. The terms that I hear thrown around at these various conferences I've been to, Christians are, at least fundamental Christians, those who believe in the fundamental truths of Scripture and the very basics of Scripture, are viewed as fundies. I've heard us being referred to as bigots or extremists. And one gentleman went so far as to describe fundamental Christianity as being tribal in nature. Marcus Braybrook, who is a president of the World Congress of Faiths, he wrote that, I'll give you a quick quote, because it's interesting. He wrote, quote, "The interfaith vision is in tune with the character of the emerging postmodern global society. Indeed, it offers the hope of a world civilization based on spiritual values, whereas the fundamentalist approach is likely only to lead to confrontation and conflict," unquote. See, we're the troublemakers. In their mind, we are the troublemakers. So we can be tolerant of all religions, and we can claim all religions to have validity, but when it comes to the exclusive message of Jesus Christ, well, sorry, that we can't tolerate, because now you're stepping on the sacred cow of this global faith idea of religion and spirituality as a shaper for a global society.
And until people understand that there really is an intense hatred of Christianity, and of course it's what drives this whole movement, but because if you get beyond the superficial parts of this, and there is certainly a very real spirituality that really falls into the occultic beliefs. And the occultism, the New Agers can be very comfortable with that, and the Theosophists and the Masons and the Rosicrucians, but don't you dare, of course, mention the divinity of Jesus Christ. That's why there was so much antagonism towards the movie, The Passion of the Christ. It was the passion play, how terrible it was. Anti-Semitic, terrible. No, it's because they hate Christianity. Well, go ahead, Carl. Pick up the story.
Certainly. The thing that kind of struck me when I was attending many of these meetings is not just that there was an intense animosity against Christianity, but that these people actually believed in what they were doing. they actually believed that they were going to bring about world peace based on this concept of merging religions. And part of that belief stems from the erroneous held position that religion is the leading cause of war and conflict in the world. In fact, I wrote an article not that long ago on this whole problem, this lie, this massive lie that we can have a world faith to create world peace. And the lie really goes along the lines of this, that religion is responsible for the greatest amount of conflict, the greatest amount of suffering in humankind's history. And there's a number of prominent writers who went along this line, and I've heard this kind of rhetoric from the radio talk shows and TV programs, so on. So, Dr. Monteith, what I did was really simple. I took a look at the 20th century, our last century, and recognizing it was the bloodiest century in the entire history of humankind, I chose a minimum death figure of 1.5 million. Now, 1.5 million was an arbitrary number I just chose, but I had to start somewhere. And then from there, all the conflicts that were concrete with death totals above 1.5 million, I tabulated those conflicts with the time frame they took place, the estimated dead, and the central cause. And I came up with a pile of major conflicts and wars and human-caused genocides that were above the 1.5 million figure. And after reviewing the central causes of all these different events, religion never really played much of an issue at all. In fact, the four big ones, World War I, World War II, Stalin, and Sherman Mao, none of them were could be classified as the result of classical religion. Now, if you want to say that religion, you can stretch religion out to be so broad it becomes meaningless. So I had to define this in terms of classical religion, be it Christianity, be it Islam, and so on. The only battles in the 20th century or conflicts in the 20th century where 1.5 million dead or more occurred that had a religious flavor stemmed around, for the most part, Islamic issues. And when I started doing this intense research into the causes of these massive human catastrophes, it smacked me in the face. Religion is not the cause. Perpetuating the lie that religion is the cause automatically assumes that religion has to find the answer. And so that's the approach that many within the interfaith movement are taking. They genuinely are saying, well, we really believe that religion is the cause of all this war and strife. Hence, it's our responsibility, it's our duty to man to look at using religion as a force for quote-unquote world peace. Unfortunately, any time mankind imposes a utopian dream, it inevitably becomes a bloody utopian dream. And that is something that most people just don't really understand. Whenever we have this idea that we can control each other and that we can do it from our own high motives or altruistic motives, be it the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man.
Hold that thought, we'll be right back here in a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest, Carl Tykrib, and we're talking about this belief of these intellectuals who are really leading this move towards world government, that the wars are really brought about by religious differences. And of course, Carl commented that he had studied all the wars of the last century, the most bloodiest century, using the figure 1.5 million as the basis to whether this was going to be analyzed. And the only real situations he could find where more than 1.5 million people were killed that had to do with religion, had to do with the Muslims killing Christians. Would that be a fair statement?
Yeah, especially within the Sudanese issue. For the most part, of the many, many, many examples that ended up cropping up, religion actually played 0% of an actual a causation factor.
Of course, there was the Armenian slaughter, the 1917-1920 period, but that was Muslims killing Christians.
That's right. Much of it was based on more or less political control or political expansionism, so on, balance of power. I mean, the four grossest examples of bloodshed in the 20th century were not attributed to classical religion in any way, shape, or form. World War I, World War II, Stalin, and Communist China Chairman Mao and his Cultural Revolution. Those are just four real extreme examples, but they were the biggest, baddest, most horrific examples of death, massive human-caused death in the 20th century. Now, if religion was responsible, as these interfaith intellectuals believe, and believe erroneously that religion is responsible for all the world's sorrows and death, and especially the wars and conflict, well, then the logical step in their mind is that religion has to take a leading role in bringing about world peace, reversing these wrongs. And that's where you get the political and the religious element starting to blend. It's kind of fascinating. I was at a United Religions Initiative meeting with the World Federalist Association, which is the U.S. Largest U.S.-based world government lobby group. They've since changed their name. They've morphed into a different organization. The essentials are all still the same, though. It's just Leopard changing its spots, that's all. And during this one-day meeting in D.C. between the URI and the World Federalist Association, one of the speakers made a real profound statement, a historical statement I'd never heard of before. And that was that in 1951, actually on April the 6th, 1951, Pope Pius XII held a special meeting at the Vatican with the World Movement for World Federal Government. And that during this time that he spent with these world government advocates, he made it very clear that this was the direction that the Church, quote-unquote the Catholic Church, and the Vatican were specifically heading towards, and that he was giving them kudos for their involvement in trying to bring about world government. Well, it took me about 3 years to track down a copy of this actual speech. I ended up finding it in an archive of a major Catholic university. It took some time to find out where to get this. I ended up making the road trip and actually getting a copy of it just to see, is this what's being said? And after reviewing the document, it was obvious that this is exactly what was being said. And that's just one example of politics and religion blending. Now, not all Catholics obviously agree or even want or hope ever to have a one-world religion, just as most others within any group of freedom-loving people don't want to see one-world religion or a one-world government. But at the highest levels, we see that this is a fundamental goal. This is something that is paramount.
Well, of course, the same movement is present within the Protestant Church as well. I mean, certainly not perhaps as well defined as what you're describing, but there is this movement within the Catholic Church, within the Protestant Church, certainly within the Jewish religion.
It knows no bounds.
It knows no bounds, and really there's an organized effort to bring about this one world government using religion and joining religions together. After all, don't we all worship the same God? And well, we really don't all worship the same God. Certainly, the Catholic, the Protestant, and the Jew are looking for the Messiah. Well, the Jews are waiting for the Messiah to come. We're waiting for him to come again. But we recognize that the Jewish Messiah is the Christ, or is Jesus Christ, I shouldn't say the Christ, because there are literally millions of people out there who have embraced the New Age who are waiting for the Christ to come, and that certainly is not Jesus Christ. And I'm sure you've encountered that, haven't you, Carl?
Oh, yes. Absolutely. Without question.
All right. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment with Carl, and we're going to be exploring this idea of spirituality, how it works hand in glove with this drive towards world government. And we are moving rapidly away from traditional Christianity in America towards this new spirituality. Well, go right ahead there.
All right. Well, you know, Dr. Monteith, the thing that was, for myself, one of the first places I ever really encountered this was in 1997 at a conference in Vancouver, Canada. That was with the Global Citizenship Youth Congress. And Robert Mueller was the keynote, gave the keynote address. And of course, he was the United Nations Undersecretary General. He held many postings in the United Nations and so on.
And he was certainly a member of the Lucis Trust, which,
yes,
of course, came out of the Lucifer Trust.
Absolutely. And what was fascinating was that this Congress, which was mostly made up of young people, educators, school officials, and so on, the idea was to create a World Core curriculum, or actually to bring the World Core curriculum into the mainstream of Canadian education. What was really fascinating was his emotional plea to have these students and educators and faculty members understand their own divinity. And he pushed on that and pushed on that and pushed on that, making emotional appeals to the idea of Gaia, Mother Earth, talking about various aspects of creating a United Religions Initiative, which he did take a big part in.
Could you sort of develop that idea of people realizing or recognizing their own divinity? Because that's something which I think is a little foreign to most Christians.
Yeah, it's very foreign to most Christians because we recognize that we're sinners. We, as Christians, we recognize that we don't make the standard. We don't make the cut. We have broken God's laws and will be judged by a perfect judge. And so the idea that we are our own Christ, that we are divine within ourselves, is completely foreign to the biblical concept of what it means to have a relationship with Jesus Christ, or what it means to be a Christian, or what it means to have an understanding of God and who He is. But within this, you could say, the occult metaphors, the esoteric language, the idea is that you, Dr. Monteith, myself, and anybody else walking on this planet, that we are little gods. We are deities. We just haven't recognized it yet. We have forgotten that we're gods. We have forgotten that we have that spark of the divine within. And when we awaken ourselves to that, then we can push that. We can grow it. We can encounter it. And we find so many mystical paths that take us down that direction. Yoga, various mystical type of activities like labyrinth walks, which are now really becoming infused within even Protestant circles. And so we see this as...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Carl Tykrib, and we're talking about this concept that it is the esoteric belief that we are God. Now, that may sound a little surprising to a lot of people, but this is the occultic belief. We are each have within us the spark of God. That means that we are little gods, and if we can reach the divinity within ourselves by yoga or by meditation or by labyrinths or one of these other techniques, perhaps of using psychedelic drugs, this is how we can find ourselves. Using certainly the Indians use these various psychedelic mushrooms, and some people use marijuana for the religious experience that they have. But, of course, all of these ideas are founded within the occult. Because, of course, as Carl pointed out, a Christian recognizes we are sinners, and our only hope of salvation is through the sacrifice of Jesus Christ. But that is not this other belief. And what most people do not understand is that there are literally millions of people throughout the world who believe in this. And, of course, they believe in the other occult beliefs laid out by Robert Mueller, and certainly he was a disciple of Alice Bailey, who was a disciple of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. And all of this gets into the occult, and actually, in my estimation, a belief in another God who is superior to the God of the Bible, and is certainly Alistair, but not... the gentleman who wrote Morals and Dogma, Albert Pike, talked about the God, the supreme God, and then the lesser God who created the heaven and the earth, and you wonder what he's talking about. But they really have a dualistic belief. They believe that there are several gods, and they worship the true God, not the God of the Christians.
Yeah, this is something that most people don't recognize as actually a form of mental manipulation. When we were talking during the break there, we were talking a little bit about Robert Mueller, the UN Undersecretary General, and I had attended this conference It was a global citizenship youth congress in Vancouver, British Columbia. This is back in 1997. And during the conference, he was giving a keynote address, and he'd made a number of statements. He was really pushing on this idea that we were all divine, that we all had the spark of God within us. And attending this conference were very impressionable young minds, a lot of students. There were educators. There were faculty members of various schools and so on. And then the reason we were having this event was that we wanted to, well, I'm saying we because I was part of it, not that I agreed with it, we wanted to institute the World Core Curriculum within the Canadian educational framework.
Well, that was basically based upon Alice Bailey's writings, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It parallels it. Parallels it in major ways. But this is what he told the children, specifically to the children. Here's a quote. Quote, "The truth that was given by Jesus, by Muhammad, by these emissaries from outer space, they were really basic truths. And they were so great that the cosmos almost incarnated itself, behaved correctly towards the earth. You are not children of Canada. You are really living units of the cosmos, because the earth is a cosmic phenomena. We are all cosmic units. This is why religions tell you, you are divine. We are divine energy." Unquote. My word, that is mental manipulation. There's a saying that says, flattery will get you nowhere. That's wrong. Flattery will get you everywhere.
And that is absolutely so true. And wouldn't it be really nice to know that we were all really little gods, and if we could just get to that spark within us where we could be one with the cosmos, and they're manipulating so many of our children to believe that. Everything is designed to destroy their faith in the God of the Bible, in Jesus Christ, in his divinity, and his promise of salvation. And there is an organized conspiracy against Christianity. And Robert Mueller is one of the major people involved in that, former Assistant Secretary General of the United Nations, certainly one of the leaders of this whole world movement.
Yes, and what we're trying to do is we're recreating Eden in our own image. We really think that we're going to bring about our own utopian idea of Earth. And any time that we've had these types of ideologies come to the forefront, be it in a national setting or in a city-state setting or even within just religions, period, my word, we run into all kinds of problems. We run into major egos because this really is a very appealing, and it sure is appealing to the masses. You're a little god. You've got the divine within you. That's flattery. Flattery in the most gruesome sense, because it's telling you a horrendous lie that you are much more important than you really think you are. And that sin doesn't come into the equation. In fact, just the opposite. How could you have sin? Really, because you're God. And by making your own choices and your own decisions, you're now perfectly illuminated. It's the Luciferian principle, actually. The idea that we are now enlightened, we are illumined, we are given an intellect to choose, and in so doing we become our own God, we make our own choices, and we can thumb our noses, we can figuratively spit in the face of the true God, and essentially put ourselves on the throne, or attempt to put ourselves on the throne. This was really Lucifer's downfall, Satan's downfall, we find it biblically. It's pride, the bottom line. It's pride. Not only is it pride, it's pride where there is no longer any fear of God, because in your own mind you have now bought a lie that you are God. Now, the frightening part of all this is when you add this ideology in to politics, what kind of madmen do you end up having? Well, you end up having the Hitlers, you end up having the Stalins, you end up having the Maos. You ended up having a bloody utopian dream that turns into a horrific nightmare, that if we end up seeing this world parliament, this world government system come into place, and I firmly believe that we will, give it enough time. In fact, we don't have to give it even a lot of time, but give it enough time, give it the right circumstances, certainly give it the right momentum, be it either a global collapse of the economy or some other catastrophic event that the people scream for global democracy or a global form of governance. And this is one reason why I tell people why we should be aware of this world government movement, because this is the kind of people it draws to its center. It's the pursuit of power unbridled. And that is so difficult for us to understand here in the West, because we vote. We have freedoms. And we're able to sit back, and for the most part, we come home from work, we sit on the couch, we crack a cool one and flip on the remote, and we don't think about the very fact that our freedom is dependent, and it is so dependent on our knowledge of how these principles work. Because as soon as we are intellectually lazy and we no longer take that into consideration, the truths that have driven history, then we are poised to repeat it. And we always repeat history in a more catastrophic way than the time before.
And how wonderful it would be to have a man in the Oval Office who had a real fear of God, rather than figuring that he was going to be able to figure out how to make life better for us and for the people in Iraq and Afghanistan and all throughout the world. You know, and when we have leaders who want to transform the world through their efforts rather than through the power of the Holy Spirit, why, we get into real trouble.
Absolutely, because now we're doing this not only in our own strength, but we're doing it in the collective idea that our little movement, be it whatever you want to call it, be it conservatism or be it liberalism or be it whatever label you want to put, that now we elevate that to the position of world dogma, and that somehow that's going to be our saving grace. Somehow we're going to save ourselves from ourselves and from each other by following our little man-made philosophies. And it never works. Historically, it never, ever works. And how arrogant, how utterly arrogant of us to think that we're going to make it work this time or the next time. No. All we do is we create more havoc while we try to create Eden on Earth.
And, of course, the reason America was a great nation was because, at least initially, we did have men in positions of office who did fear God and who believed in the Constitution, who wanted to abide by the Constitution, was based upon one concept, and that is man was sinful, and you could never give him power over other men. So why would you want to have a federal government that could provide for the people and take care of the people and regulate the people? And this would lead to tyranny. Our founding fathers recognized that. And that was the genius of America, and why for so many years we were a great nation, and people came from all over the world because they wanted to be free. And by free, I mean they wanted to live in a society where government could not regulate and control them. But there has been, in my estimation, since the inception of our nation, the people from the dark side here as well, who have a different worldview. And they believe that man can create this utopia. But first of all, we've got to destroy Christianity. We've got to destroy a belief in the God of the Bible and centralize all power in the hands of the philosopher kings, as it were. The true rulers who, not the president, the president has simply become a figurehead, but the people who work within the shadows behind the scenes. And their dedication and loyalty is not to America, but to this globalist dream. Have you run into that concept?
Oh, certainly, in major, major ways. The next logical position or the next logical step with that is if we can have this at a nationalistic level, well, we then deserve this at a global level. It's not just that I have a concern about the nation. I certainly do, and I'm not even an American. I am in a larger context. I'm a Canadian. My home country is Canada. I don't want to see this happen to my country of Canada. I don't want to see this happen to your country of America. And I certainly don't want to see this happen on a global level with a global form of government. We're nailing the lid down on the coffin, and then we're wrapping it with chains and we're throwing on padlocks. I mean, we're really putting ourselves in a box as soon as we go down this road. But the thing is, and you know this very well, Dr. Monteith, we've been going down this road for a long, long, long time. And what we're just seeing is we're seeing the culmination of this in so many different areas. And when we look at globalization, we can't forget the economics, the politics, and all the stuff that makes it work, certainly. But even more important, we cannot forget the motives, the philosophy, the religious reasons why this is coming about. And if we really ignore it, we do ourselves a great disservice. And so this is all very important to see that this fits together. And especially when you start looking at the philosophy of it, then it really starts to make sense. This is why we're doing it. There's a spiritual motivation that goes far beyond what we see in the newspapers or what we read or what we see on television.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and I think it's so important people understand that this whole move towards world government is really driven by spiritual forces, but it involves some of the wealthiest people in the world who have embraced this other philosophy. And until we understand that the great wealth of the world is behind the move towards world government, and the leaders of the Christian movement, and both Catholic and Protestant and so many others, embrace these same basic philosophies. And this is why the steamroller is rolling ahead, and there doesn't seem to be any means at all to stop it. I'm not saying that God couldn't intervene and do it, but the tragedy is most people have no idea what's going on. In fact, most people don't even really understand there's a serious problem.
I know. Things as simple as just understanding how politics and religion become blended is foreign to most people, even not just on a national or even a local level, but on a global level. The Earth Charter. The Earth Charter is not a long document. It's a short, short document. But the Earth Charter has implications that will be international in scope and is specifically aimed to change the way you look at the world, your social values, your beliefs, the fundamental core of what you hold to be dear.
And of course, most people have never heard of the Earth Charter. In fact, you and I were in a debate, a discussion this morning, and I brought that subject up, and the fact that it calls for equitable redistribution of wealth, equitable distribution of wealth within nations, between nations. And I think most people who heard me say that thought I was crazy as I talked about how this new Ten Commandments for the world is kept in something called the Ark of Hope, which is an occult a counterpart of the Ark of the Covenant.
Mm-hmm.
But everything is really a mirror image of a Christian belief. The other side believes in Christianity. They just reject it.
Yes. Oh, yeah. What really boggles me is when you have people say, well, you know, that's just a conspiracy theory. That doesn't really go on. Listen, the first time I ever really ran into the Earth Charter, besides just reading the document online and reading the document from some various organizations I connected in with, the first time I actually had a chance to have this thing hashed over was with Stephen Rockefeller when he gave his presentation at the United Nations Millennium Forum. And we had a special session just set aside to work through the Earth Charter, and this was in the spring of 2000.
And for our listeners, of course, Stephen Rockefeller is David Rockefeller's nephew, the son of Nelson Rockefeller, who's gone to his justly reward. So, what did Stephen Rockefeller have to say? I mean, he's a doctor, he's a professor, a brilliant individual, but also deeply involved in the occult.
Well, he was there primarily to promote his Earth Charter and then to get critical feedback from the people who are involved at the United Nations Millennium Forum. Really, what he was doing was he was introducing it for the first time at the United Nations, though it was certainly a smaller session than I think originally it was intended to be. I know that it was unveiled officially to a much larger and much more important audience. But in a sense, what we were a bit of a sounding board, and at that point in time, it was going through its final phases. It had just gone through its final construction, and he was seeking some feedback and really looking for support. And the event that I was part of there really brought a lot of the largest pro-global governance organizations together, and what he was seeking was not so much their support, because he already had it. He was looking for endorsement. He was looking to help us. Again, I'm using the us, not that I've agreed with it, but because I was a part of it. He was hoping that we would take this and now use it as our central pillar.
In fact, of course, both Gorbachev and Marie Strong, who at least were involved with giving their names to this, call this the new Ten Commandments for the world.
Certainly.
The new Ten Commandments, that's why it's kept in the Ark of Hope. The Luciferian counterpart, the counterfeit Ark of the Covenant for today. This is the new means of guiding the world. They call it the New Ten Commandments. It's so important for people to understand this is the agenda. This is the Mein Kampf for everything going on. The Earth Charter, and any of our listeners who can't get it off the Internet, we'll be glad to send you one free of charge. If you give us a call, we'll give you the number later. Go ahead, Carl.
Well, I was just going to say what kind of surprised me one time. I wrote to the Earth Charter organization in the U.S. This is already a few years ago, and I got the Earth Charter in a package from the Humane Society of America. And it turned out that the Humane Society of America and the Earth Charter organization, they were completely networked and partnering. And not only that, they became, in essence, one and the same. And so even at the most grassroots level, you're finding that, that this agenda is making its way in deeper and deeper, not just in the educational realms, but within all members and fabrics of our society, which, of course, is what Arthur C. Clarke would said.
And of course, this
is 50 years.
And what this is the new Mein Kampf. This is the plan for America. If you haven't read it, you should read it. It's the plan for the world. Introducing a new spirituality, a new sense of values to humanity. Well, go ahead, Carl. We've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Certainly. What I'd like to do in when we come back on, if it's okay with you, I've got a fantastic quote that just sums it up perfectly. It was a quote from a lady by the name of Lucille Green. I'd met her personally at World Federalist Association events. And she was a close friend with Robert Mueller and had been very involved at a number of different levels within the United Nations and within the World Federalist Association and also within the World Constitution and Parliamentary Association. I think she was the third signer of their global constitution, the framework that they kind of put in place, hoping that the world would accept it. And of course, it hasn't yet, but who knows? It was an exercise that certainly helped to propel this whole movement forward. And the terminology that she uses is really fascinating because she blends the politics and the religion together, the East and the West, in such a way that it's unmistakable that there is a drive here that is much bigger than just the Western world. It's much bigger than just the Eastern world. It's really fundamentally the two together. It's democracy. And at the same time, what it is, it's we are democratically taking and putting ourselves into the jaws of the trap. And democracy is something that I hear over and over again as this global benchmark we're supposed to attain. Now, democracy is a fantastic form of government, but it also represents the rule of the mob. And when we've flattered up the mob enough or given them enough scare tactics, then the mob is ready to embrace whatever it is that comes along to be the savior. And whether it's in a social, spiritual, political, economic context, it's so important to understand that this is something that is taking place right now. We're not talking about something far off in the future. We're talking about something right now. So when we come back on, I sure would like to read that quote because it's a few lines long, but it really says it well, and it does it in such a way that it blends that politics and that religion in a way that is so evident. I just wish, though, that the American people and the people of Europe, the people of Asia, the Christians around the world, because we are around the world, I wish we would just wake up to this. But I don't see that happening. I see it happening at a small level. And for the most part, what I see is I see Christians falling asleep to this or succumbing to it. And we all hear the flattery, you deserve it, you deserve it. I mean, it's in all the advertisements.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment with
sure.
Carl.
Yep.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. We're just about done, but I want... Carl has a quotation. He thinks he explains pretty well what's going on as far as this new spirituality. If you want to go ahead and give the quotation, Carl.
Yes, certainly. This was given by a lady by the name of Lucille Green, who was very influential with the World Federalist Association and at multiple levels within the United Nations. And this is what she wrote, and I thought it just summed it up perfectly. Your listeners need to listen carefully. Quote, "A holistic, one-world view is emerging from space travel and other miracles of modern technology and from communication. A consciousness is also emerging from a growing awareness in the West of the wisdom of the Eastern world view. Buddhism, Hinduism, Taoism, and Shinto, while they differ in many respects, portray the world as a multidimensional, organically interrelated ecosystem of which man is one of many interdependent parts. Perhaps we can learn through them to see the world whole as it really is, and together, West and East, begin to build the foundations of a new world order. The most urgent item on the planetary agenda is to set the limits of freedom and order in supranational global affairs. A constitution for the world is needed which combines the achievements of both hemispheres, that is, constitutional limitations and a bill of rights from the West and a spacious worldview from the East.
Amen. Well, I wouldn't say amen to that. I would say that the frightening thing when you realize, of course, that this means the end of Christianity. Well, of course, they're never going to triumph, but Christianity will eventually, come forward into its own. But, well, how many of us will be here? We won't know for some time. Carl, I want you to get your web page out so people will know how to get in touch with you and get more of your information.
Absolutely. If folks want to, some of my writing is on at the August Review. You just need to type in www.augustreview.com, and there are some fantastic articles and reports there that really help to bridge all of this and put it together in a way that is understandable and very timely and important.
All right, fine. And certainly we recommend that. That's augustreview.com. Carl, thank you so very much for being with us, and I'll look forward to getting you onto some of our other programs as well.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Dr. Monteith.
Bye-bye. God bless.
Bye-bye.
All right, fine. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and this is the time when I want to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope many of you give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. I do want to mention that we do carry things just to help our ministry, such as we have the Robinson Homeschool curriculum, and we sell a shortwave. We actually have the Berkey products and the Miracle Tooth products, and we have health products. If you'd like to know any more about any of them, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. We do hope that if you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you'll get it, because it will put not only the political but the spiritual into a clear focus. That's the Brotherhood of Darkness, the book, the DVD, the video, or the Brotherhood of Darkness special that has all of them together. And then, of course, to understand this other dimension of spirituality, we have our 4-tape set on the supernatural. We have the wonderful book, The Beautiful Side of Evil, by Johanna Michelson, who is a medium, who, of course, witnessed the wonderful, wonderful supernatural things that are there for the asking, but unfortunately, where you're tapping into a dark and demonic spirits. And certainly, let me simply mention our 4-tape sets on Satanism and deliverance and other similar items. They're so important that you have access to the information, and this is one thing that Radio Liberty does. Go to our website at www.radioliberty.com. That's radioliberty.com, and you'll get a whole different vision of what's going on. And we have 4-tape sets. We have videos, some of them I've produced, others that have been produced by my friends. To understand in visual form what we're talking about, you need to get Chris Pinto's wonderful DVDs and videos, Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2, and, of course, the latest presentation, The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. That's The Secret Mysteries of America's Beginning. So certainly we ask you, of course, to pray for America, to pray for revival, to pray for our leaders and pray for our ministers, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please don't call until we ask for calls, and we'll probably do that later in the program. But right now we have with us on the line from the East Coast, Arthur Bernclaw. It's very late, but he's with Veterans for Constitutional Law. Arthur, thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Okay, and how are you this evening, Doctor?
I'm doing just fine, thank you. I just got through, we did a debate early in the morning, and we've done 4 hours. This will be my sixth hour of talk radio today. It's always invigorating. But anyway, certainly Arthur has worked with a group trying to make sure that veterans get a fair shake as far as their benefits. You know, it's one thing to send young men off to fight, and then, of course, you promise them that they'll be looked after if they're injured. But so often we find that once the veteran comes home, why, he's part of the expendable elite. And we just sort of brush them aside and hope they don't make too much noise, because they're really sort of bothersome. And many of these men, very courageous men, have given so much for our country. And, well, we've seen this in war after war after war. And I fear that we're seeing it again after the most recent war. But you pick us up, Arthur, and tell us what's really going on in the Veterans Administration world.
Well, these are very scary times, not only because of the war, but because of what's happening here on the home front, too. When I say the home front, a lot of people don't consider this as a war that's going on. They consider it as a police action. Well, they also considered Korea as a police action. They also considered Vietnam as a police action. But there were wars, Dr. Stan, and the casualties that we suffered show that they were wars. And the last one we had before this, we had 58,000 die there in Vietnam. And so far, according to the figures the government gave us, we have over 2,500 now, but we don't know whether those figures are correct. There's so many aspects to this. And there was another aspect of people who died who were shipped off to a hospital in Germany, in Landstuhl Hospital, about 150-bed hospital, and people who died en route, and we're getting a figure of something like 6,000 that we're trying to have confirmed that have died there already.
Okay, then they separate Afghanistan from Iraq, anything to keep the figures down, but certainly I think we can say that, certainly with a great deal of assuredness, that about 20,000 either killed or wounded in Iraq alone.
Yes.
And how many more in Afghanistan, we don't know, and how many have died after they left Iraq, we don't know, because they're not being forthcoming. It is all they're playing games with the minds of the American people. They don't want them to become enraged and demand we pull our troops out, because we don't intend to leave there. We intend to keep our troops permanently stationed there. How can I say that? Well, number one, because we're building the largest embassy anywhere in the world, right there in Baghdad, over $1 billion now and still spending. But more than that, if you read the writings of the New American Century, Project for the New American Century, on their website, newamericancentury.org, in the treatise on rebuilding America's defenses, they will tell you they intend to keep our troops permanently stationed in the Middle East. And, of course, if you don't have a war going, how can you justify that? And, after all, we're only losing 2 or 3 a day. We could keep this war going for an awfully long time before the American people really tire of it. And, of course, we forget that every one of those young men who dies, and every Iraqi, too, is a unique individual made in the image and likeness of God. Arthur, go right ahead now.
Mr. Bush has asked for another $1.5 billion. Another $1.5 billion. So far, He's been granted $595 million to build that embassy, and they've run out of money. Now, he's asking Congress for another $1.5 billion, and Congress is very likely going to give him the money. I don't know what the hold he has over Congress, but they seem to give this man everything he wants. And nobody seems to stand up against him in Congress. Now, he's putting this embassy up on 104 acres. Now, if you can get the concept of this, Dr. Stan, it's consisting of 21 buildings and will house over 8,000 workers. I've never heard of an embassy that size. And I'm wondering, what is he building? Is he building an embassy or is he building a palace? We don't know what he is building, but they're claiming they're going to get out of Iraq as soon as possible. To spend this kind of money over there, I think we're going to stay there permanently, Dr. Stan. I think he's got plans to stay in that country permanently.
Well, I think that the people who control Mr. Bush have those plans, and I think he is simply the front man for some very powerful men who want to keep a permanent American presence in the Middle East, and you keep that there with military might, and that's why you cannot allow this war to end. You could say that you want it to end. Oh, we're going to Iraqicize the war. We're going to build up the Iraqi military so they can take over, but we never seem to get around to being able to do that, and that's because even the Wall Street Journal recently commented that we don't feed the Iraqis troops well. I mean, their minutes of the food that they get is rancid and makes them ill. We don't equip them well. We do everything we can to demoralize them, and then we wonder why the Iraqi military can't take over so we can bring our boys home. I don't think they have any intention of bringing them home. And when you understand that, so much of what's going on really begins to make sense. It's Vietnam all over again.
Well, the food services down there are being run by Halliburton. And there's an awful lot of corruption going on there with Halliburton. There's an awful lot of things that should be being done and are not being done. And it seems like nobody holds Halliburton to account. Nobody.
Well, of course, if you did, you'd get into real trouble with Dick Cheney, because at least for some time after he became vice president, he continued to get something called a deferred salary. Now, I'm not sure what a deferred salary is from a major corporation that has contracts with the government. Some people might think that that was a conflict of interest. Some people might think that was collusion. Some of the people might think that that was actually the payment for services rendered. But be that as it may, Dick Cheney got a deferred salary from Halliburton after he became vice president. We'll be right back. All right, Arthur, you pick up the story there.
No, I think there's a conflict of interest. Now, I can get arguments in Washington on that, but I just had a couple of things come across my desk today, and I think Teddy had it so right. We're not talking about Teddy Kennedy, but we're talking about Teddy Roosevelt. And his ideas on immigrants and being an American, and this goes back to 1907. This is out of a speech by Teddy Roosevelt. And he states here, in the first place, we should insist that if the immigrant who comes here in good faith becomes an American and assimilates himself to us, he shall be treated on an exact equality with everyone else, for it is an outrage to discriminate against any such man because of creed or birthplace or origin. But this is predicated upon the person's becoming in every facet an American, and nothing but an American. There can be no divided allegiance here. Any man who says he's an American, but something else also, isn't an American at all. We have room for but one flag, the American flag, and we have room for but one language here, and that is the English language. And we have room for one loyalty, and that is loyalty to the American people. And Theodore Roosevelt said that in 1907. And every American citizen has to read that. They have to read that, and they have to know that. Because back in 1907, it hasn't changed one bit since then. These ideas still go today, but many of us have forgotten it. Now, another thing I just came across my desk yesterday, we have some laws that we're trying to pass, and we're trying to get veterans to have legal representation in VA claims. Now, this is this came from the Disabled American Veterans, and I'll name the party. Lisa Bogle in the Washington office has sent this out to all their members, and it's attorneys in claim process. It says, take action. I mean, this, I'll read this to you, and if you don't agree with me that this is one of the lowest things in creation, by a veterans organization who is supposed to be an advocate for veterans, the largest in the whole country, the Disabled American Veterans, the DAV. And here's what it says. Legislation has been introduced in both the House and the Senate, known as the Veterans Choice of Representation Act. H.R. 4914 and S-2694. These bills would amend Title 38 United States Code, that's the veterans laws, to remove certain limitations on attorney representation of claimants for veterans benefits in administrative proceedings before the Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA. The reason this legislation has been introduced, according to staff from both House and Senate Veterans Affairs Committee, is that veterans have been complaining about not having the right to hire an attorney to represent them during the claims process. And that's a fact. You're not allowed to have an attorney represent you during your claims process. The Disabled American Veterans, the DAV, is concerned that the current claims process does not work properly. They're concerned it hasn't worked properly for 75 years. We believe Congress should focus on correcting the process, not making it more adversarial and legalistic. The question should not be whether veterans have a right to hire an attorney, but how to improve claims processing. Clearly, the solution is not to allow attorneys into the process. The VA benefits delivery system was designed to be open, informal, and helpful to veterans. The goal was to ensure that veterans receive the benefits a grateful nation had provided for them, rather than discourage or inhibit their claims with government red tape or lengthy litigation. Allowing attorneys into the process would interfere with this goal and will create a system that is far more adversarial and legalistic and less veteran-friendly. I urge you to write your representative and senators, urging them to oppose the enactment of this bill and to truly focus the attention of Congress on ways to ensure the process performs in the manner for which it was designed. An ex parte, non-adversarial system with the VA being obligated to provide all benefits allowable under the law. Now, this is as low as it comes. Now, these people, they're concerned with one thing. They're freebies. And they get free rent in any VA building or hospital.
Now, but for our listeners, what Arthur is saying is that the Disabled American Veterans Organization does, and they simply are an extension of the Veterans Administration,
exactly,
whose job is not to provide for our veterans, but to keep them from getting their veterans. And right now, for 75 years, veterans have not had anybody to represent them within the system. They're easily intimidated. These things drag out ad infinitum. And the law says they can't have a lawyer until they've gone through the process. It can take them 10, 15 years, something like that.
Sometimes as long as 50 years.
And so, ladies and gentlemen, this is an excellent idea. And many veterans, at least responsible veterans, want the ability to hire a lawyer. The Disabled American Veterans does not represent the veterans. It represents an elite who've been put into those positions to perpetuate a failed system. What we need is an adversarial system. They will get something with the veterans, because you say what you want to about, you want them to get a fair shake, you want them to get what they're entitled to. Where's the Disabled American Veterans been for the last 75 years? They want, to block any effort to try to change the system. That's
right.
What it's about, isn't it?
They've been working hand in hand with the VA to keep denying claims to veterans. The veteran, in essence, is not represented by any of these service organizations. They are not a lobby for the veteran. They are a lobby for the VA, and they always have been. And, for them to send this out, this puts everything on the table. You can look at it and you can say, hey, the VA and the DAV, they're one and the same. There is no difference. They are one and the same. And veterans should be alerted, and they should contact every congressman and every senator that they can and say, hey, we want the same right as other American citizens. We want the right to hire an attorney if we need one.
And, of course, what a gift are those pieces of legislation. And I do hope that everybody out there in the listening audience
okay.
who is a veteran will certainly write to their congressman and senator. Because, of course, the whole idea is they're trying to create a groundswell of opposition to this legislation.
Exactly.
Whereas every veteran should be supporting it.
Well, in the House, it's H.R. 4914. H.R. 4914. That's the one you should contact your congressman about. And in the Senate, it's Senate Bill number S-2694.
All right,
and I think we should besiege every congressman and senator in this country to get out and get these two laws passed.
Now, how did this legislation even get this far as it's gotten? I mean, were you involved with that, Arthur?
Yes. Yeah, I was involved and other veterans advocates were involved. And I'm proud to say not one of the chartered veteran service organization took part in this to try to have this promoted. Not one. Not the American Legion, not the DAV, not the VFW, not Vietnam Veterans of America, not the Military Order of the Purple Heart. They're all of one mind. And that one mind is to withhold benefits from the veteran. Period. And their freebies count. Their freebies are all they're concerned about. Getting things like free rent, free telephone, free stationery, free computer equipment, free furniture. You know, they don't pay a button in these VA buildings. The VA provides all of them for it, and you want to know why. They're providing it for them as a payback for what they're doing, or let's put it this way, for what they're not doing for veterans.
And, of course, they all, I'm sure, have lots of veterans that belong to them, that pay the dues, that pay the salaries, but the veterans are not getting a fair shake in America. What about your organizations, and are there other organizations that really do represent the veterans?
There are quite a few smaller organizations that are representing the veterans. Now, we don't collect dues from veterans. A veteran can belong and his family, anyone in his family can join. We do not collect dues. All we say is we want you to read, we want you to know what we're doing, we want you to know what the VA is doing and what the government is doing, and make your voice heard, first to the media, then to Congress. It's the media you should usually go to first. But in this case, we're asking you to go directly to Congress on here and get these two laws passed. And if we pass these two laws, that's going to put an end to the legal turf of the DAV and the American Legion and all this double-teaming a veteran in a hearing. Because we'll look at it this way. The veterans established, the Veterans Administration established their own court in 1988. And since that was established, November 1988, there has been 18,000 cases go before this court. We have a grand total to date of 191 veteran wins since this court was established. 191 wins in the veterans court.
Out of how many cases brought?
18,000. Less than 1%.
Far less than 1%. So basically this whole thing is jury-rigged ahead of time to keep the veterans from really getting a fair shake. And that's why they do not want the veterans to have legal representation. Because believe me, the lawyers would make mincemeat out of it. How much do they spend, the Veterans Administration, fighting the veterans to keep them from getting their benefits?
Well, I'll give you an idea of what they're spending here. They have something called the VA Press Corps. And they're paid per year $65,000 to $85,000, and there's 30 in every Veterans Administration regional office and 120 in the central office. So we're talking about 2,220 spinmeisters that are paid just to keep news, any negative news about the VA out of the papers. And they're employed, they're spending all kinds of money just so they won't have to pay out veterans' benefits.
And of course they have a tremendous staff and legal staff, everything to keep the veterans from getting, what they've been promised.
Over 12,000 attorneys.
We'll be back here in just a moment. With
what do they need 12,000 attorneys for?
Well, Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Arthur Burnclough, and Arthur asked a very legitimate question. Why do they have how many attorneys?
12,000.
12,000 attorneys working with the Veterans Administration. Is that there to help the veterans, or is that to keep them from getting the benefits that by law they're supposed to get? And what you have to understand, ladies and gentlemen, is that our Congress is simply a figurehead. The Congress votes all sorts of money for the veterans and requirements to provide benefits for the veterans. And then, of course, the VA, as an independent bureaucracy, is set up to block giving those benefits. And the average citizen, unless they've been involved with this system, has no idea what's really going on. Sure. It's only the veterans, of course, many of them, are relegated to a situation of perpetual poverty along with their families, who understands the frustration of this bureaucracy gone mad. So pick up the story there.
Okay, now in the House Veterans Affairs Committee, this was chaired by Congressman Christopher Smith of New Jersey, who was not what you'd call a veterans advocate, but he was relatively fair. Now, he was fired by Mr. Bush and replaced immediately by a fellow by the name of Steve Beyer, B-U-Y-E-R, from Indiana. Now, Steve Beyer is a Gulf veteran, so you'd figure he'd be trying to help other veterans. Not so. Steve Beyer is a total psychopath. Steve Beyer is a Gulf veteran, but you look up his background, he was a JAG officer in the Air Force who doesn't like other veterans. Not 1 minute of combat time. Now, why was Steve Beyer picked? Steve Beyer believes that veterans should not be getting benefits. Since the day he was put in Congress, he has attacked veterans' benefits tooth and nail. Now, I came across Steve Beyer more than 10 years ago while he was abusing a survivor of the Bataan Death March, a 94-year-old veteran. He was abusing this guy. And Steve Beyer, I finally got a chance to talk to him, and I said, Beyer, your thoughts and my thoughts on veterans are different. He is trying to redefine what a veteran is. He feels that anyone who has a 10 or 20% disability, they should pay him off in one shot and get rid of him. Now, suppose the veteran has a 10 or 20% disability. Quite a few people have 10 or 20% disabilities by the VA who should be getting 100%, but the VA has denied him. Now, if a veteran has something that gets progressively worse, an injury or a disease or just plain aging, and it gets progressively worse, and he was to take this payoff, he would not be entitled to anything for his injury afterwards. In other words, they will cut off everything at that point. Once he takes a payoff, and Beyer is pushing this as hard as he can. Now, I had a talk. I said to Beyer, we should have a talk together. We should sit down and talk about it. And he was as nasty as could be. And I said, Beyer, I don't think even if we talked, we'd get anything settled. But I have a solution. If you would fill your hand with a weapon and meet me at sundown, Beyer, I'm sure we could solve our problems. Of course, Beyer reported me to the FBI, and they asked me if I threatened a congressman. And I said, no, I didn't threaten him. It's a promise. And Beyer has had a war with almost every true veterans advocate in this country.
Hold that thought there for just a moment. We'll be right back here with Arthur Burnclough. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Arthur Burnclough from Veterans for Constitutional Law, and we're simply talking about the plight of the veteran when he gets into the massive bureaucracy. And I've seen a similar plight, within the workman's compensation system that I was unfortunately involved with because of my profession as an orthopedic surgeon. And this, of course, was simply a state bureaucracy. I can imagine what it must be like at the federal level. But I'll pick up the story there, Arthur.
Okay. Now, Beyer is, he's supporting this veterans...
This is Congressman Beyer.
Yeah, Congressman Beyer, he is supporting the Veterans Disability Benefits Commission. He is absolutely supporting them. You remember we mentioned this last time about the separation of powers, that the courts should make that decision. If they're going to change the law, let the court change the law. It's under separation of powers and in the Constitution. Now, they got a letter of support from Beyer. They got a letter of support from Larry Craig, who is with the Senate Veterans Affairs Committee. He's the new chairman. Specter is gone. Raise the flag. Let's celebrate that. And they got letters of support from a congressman you've got there in California. No, Duncan Hunter. He's a fellow out there in California that's always battling with the environmentalists. And they got a letter of support from Ike Skelton. He's the lone Democrat in the group. He's from Missouri. He's the minority head of the Armed Forces Committee. And very few congressmen are supporting this. And
they're supporting what? Is that the new legislation? This is not the new legislation. This is what's just the committee? Is
this a commission to study veterans' disability.
All right, fine.
And it's made up of 13 members. Mr. Bush appointed 5 on his own. The Republican Party appointed 4, and the Democratic Party appointed 4. But who do the Democrats appoint the 4 out of? 2 of them come from the Disabled American Veterans groups. That one group. One came from a fellow by the name of Rick Surratt. We've had a program about him at one time with the Disabled American Veterans. Another came from Charles Butch Jockel, who was kicked out of the DAV. He was discredited for using DAV funds to pay for a private attorney to defend him in a sexual harassment suit with a female member of the DAV. And this is the same Charles Jockel who wrote an amicus curiae, a friend of the court brief, for the VA. He wrote it actually for the VA and against judicial review of Veterans Administration decisions. They tried to get judicial review passed before, but it went before Congress, and Congress did not approve it. And this is a number of years ago, and now they appoint this guy as one of the 4 Democrats in the Veterans Disability Commission, and Rick Surratt is another one. So I think you know what we can expect out of the Veterans Disability Commission. And the head guy is an armchair general by the name of Terry Scott of Alabama. And every veterans advocate in Alabama has battled Terry Scott. Here's another guy that every time you turn around, Terry Scott is writing letters to everyone under the sun saying cut veterans benefits. Are you familiar, Dr. Stan, with a case of First Lieutenant Aaron Watata?
No, I'm not acquainted with the case at all.
Okay. Lieutenant Watata has refused deployment to Iraq. He refused deployment orders. And Lieutenant Aaron Watata, he's a Hawaiian-American, became the first commissioned officer to publicly refuse orders to deploy to the Iraq War. And this was at 2:30 Thursday morning. That was last week. Hours before his refusal, Lieutenant Watata confirmed his steadfast opposition to the Iraq War, and his statement was this: I am opposed to this war and the misconduct within this administration. I am willing to sacrifice my freedom and my good name to end this war and save lives, both Iraqi and American. Georgia Tagaris Gordon is a public affairs assistant in Fort Lewis, Washington State, and she says First Lieutenant Watata remained within his battalion headquarters during manifest this morning. No charges have been brought against him, and none will be brought until his commanding officers can review the facts of the case. She says roughly 4,000 soldiers are deploying with the 3-2 Striker Brigade combat team. Lieutenant Watata is currently confined to base and restricted to communicating only with his lawyer.
Okay, hold that thought. We'll be back. And when we get back, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Our guest is Arthur Bernclough, Veterans for Constitutional Law. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Go ahead and continue with the story of Lieutenant Watada.
Okay, Dr. Stan. Eric Seitz, that's S-E-I-T-Z, is Lieutenant Watada's lead defense attorney. He says, this morning, Lieutenant Watada has been restricted to base without any actual charges or proper process. By placing a complete gag order on Lieutenant Watada, the military has again shown that their first concern is silencing Lieutenant Watada's speech in opposition to the illegal war in Iraq. Seitz says he will immediately challenge these restrictions. Watada's mother, Carolyn Ho, flew to Olympia from our home in Washington to support her son in his decision. This morning, she said, my son's decision to refrain from deploying to Iraq is an act of patriotism. It is a statement to all Americans, to men and women in uniform, that they need not remain silent out of fear, that they have the power to turn the tide of history, to stop the destruction of a country and the killing of untold numbers of innocent men, women, and children. It is a message that states unequivocally that blindly following orders is no longer an option. Bob Watada is Aaron's father and also joined his son in Olympia to support him in his decision. He says he took an oath to protect and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic, and that's what he's upholding. And we have people who have committed very egregious war crimes. My son has been ordered to kill people for no reason, and he has decided he can't be a part of that, and I'm very proud of him for that stand. Now, retired Colonel Ann Wright, you may remember her from a few years ago, Dr. Stan. She resigned her position as a U.S. diplomat in 2003 to protest the Iraq War. She's in Washington State as well today and says, I'm very proud of Lieutenant Watada for making his stand of conscience. He is standing up to say this is an illegal war. This is a type of analysis that everyone in the military needs to be looking at. The war in Iraq is, in my opinion, an illegal war of aggression and a war crime. Aaron has every right to refuse to deploy to Iraq in opposition to this illegal war. Wright says she hopes others will be inspired by Lieutenant Watada's stand. Now, Lieutenant Watada says he's been receiving support from around the world since his June 7th announcement that he would refuse to deploy to Iraq. He says he's also been receiving support from individuals within the military at every rank and level. Others have called him a traitor and a coward. To that, he says, I took an oath to defend the Constitution against the United States, the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, and that means we have to hold our leaders accountable. We have to uphold the laws and values of democracy, and the elected officials are servants of the people. And
hold that thought right there. We'll be back in... Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Arthur Bernclough. And Arthur, before we go on, I want you to get your telephone number out, a web page, how people can get in touch with your organization.
I'm glad you reminded me, because that's an important thing that I keep forgetting in these programs. Thank you, Dr. Stan. We're Veterans for Constitutional Law, and we're here to help veterans with their claims and anything else, any other problems they may be having with the VA, the Department of Defense, or anybody else in government. And we can be reached at Veterans for Constitutional Law, Limited, LTD is good enough, and we're located at 112 Jefferson Avenue, and that's in Port Jefferson, New York. Our zip code is 11777, 112 Jefferson Avenue, Port Jefferson, New York, 11777. And we want to hear from you, your ideas and what we've been talking about. We're very easily accessible by telephone. Our telephone number is 631-474-4261. 631-474-4261. And if you're having a problem with the VA or any other government agency, and if there's a way we can help, we sure will try.
All right, and, fine. And so let me and if you have a question or comment on this, I think it's an important question. Is Lieutenant Watada, you know, is he right in disobeying an order to deploy? Give us your call at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Certainly does the officer in the military have the right to object? Do citizens have the right to object to what's going on? Are we still a representative government, or certainly do we have a more or less authoritarian structure that determines where American troops will be sent, what American money will be sent for, which governments we will topple, which governments we'll support? Are we really practicing the Christian aspects of our society? Are we following what George Washington had advocated about not being involved with other nations? What is the real agenda of our current administration and the agendas before that? I mean, what is the real purpose of America today? Are we protecting America? Are we projecting power throughout the world to bring about a new world order and a new world religion and realignment of nations? So if you have a question or comment, go ahead and, of course, tell us a little bit more about Lieutenant Watada. Sidney, what's happening as far as the media is concerned?
All right. Lieutenant Watada. Okay. He has also been receiving support from individuals within the military at every rank and level, and some have called him a traitor and a coward. To that, he says, "I took an oath to defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, and that means we have to make our leaders accountable. We have to uphold the laws and values of democracy, and the elected officials are servants of the people, and they must be held accountable to us, and we will not tolerate any further deception or taking us into wars based on lies and betrayal." Lieutenant Watada concludes that it's all really about what you're willing to personally sacrifice. If you believe that this war is wrong, we must end it. We must end it now or in the very near future. That you want to support the troops and bring them home alive. It takes people acting on this belief. Now, can you imagine? Just think about this, Dr. Stan. Can you imagine if there were 1 million people coming to Washington every day, what kind of an impact this would have in ending the war? And if we don't hold our leaders accountable for what they have done, they're going to continue to violate the law like they do, and they're going to continue this illegal war and sacrifice more American lives and continue with further death and destruction. And right now they're making plans to go into Iran and attack Iran. And this would be absolute insanity. But this war right now is absolute insanity that it's gone on now for 39 months. And anti-war organizers called for a solidarity set action on Tuesday, that was yesterday, in different cities around the country. And I haven't gotten any reports in from the solidarity action that they're holding, but it's been in quite a few cities. I know there was a big one here in New York, and I'm waiting to get some news on that. And God bless people like Aaron Watada. He's speaking out his conscience. And there was another lady here in Fort Benning, Army National Guard Specialist Catherine Jashinsky. She's just received a bad conduct discharge today, and she was sentenced to 120 days confinement after pleading guilty to the charge of refusal to obey a legal order. Now, she was acquitted of the more serious charge, of which they're going to be charging Lieutenant Aaron Watada, and it's called missing movement by design. That's a more serious charge. Now, with 53 days that she's already served in Fort Benning and 20 days off for good behavior, Ms. Jashinsky has 47 days of confinement remaining. Now, on November 17, 2005, Catherine Jashinsky made a public statement of conscientious objection on the eve of her scheduled deployment to Iraq. 18 months after filing, the Army denied her application for a discharge. She was then court-martialed for refusing to train with weapons. Now, Jashinsky's supporters testified they believe in the sincerity of her conscientious objective claim, and the judge noted he was convinced of the same. Aiden Delgado and Camilo Mejia, members of the Iraq Veterans Against the War, attended Ms. Jashinsky's trial today to support her. They described the atmosphere of the courtroom as initially tense, but said that Jashinsky's powerful, heartfelt testimony changed the tone of the room. Iraq Veterans Against the War support the right of every soldier to follow their conscience, said Delgado. As the first woman GI to publicly take a stand against this war and declare herself a conscientious objector, Catherine's actions are very significant. She is a fine example of a young person standing up for her beliefs, and Ms. Jashinsky is feeling very triumphant and happy to have resolution. After completing her sentence, she will return to school at the University of Texas at Austin and continue her work with the newly founded Austin GI Rights Hotline.
All right, fine. Let's go to Bill, who's calling us from Syracuse, New York. Bill, did you have any thoughts or comments on what we're talking about?
Yes, I do.
All right, go ahead.
I don't know how to pronounce that young man's name there that you're talking about, but...
Aaron Watada. W-A-T-A-D-A.
W-A-T-A-D-A. Aaron or Eric?
Aaron. E-H-R-E-N.
Aaron Watada.
Right. He's a Hawaiian-American. He's a first lieutenant in the Army.
Okay. What are your thoughts, Bill?
I think he's a hero.
All right. Well, now, certainly, can you have a military when, and I'm going to play the devil's advocate. I want you to understand that.
Okay.
How can you have a military if everybody is going to decide which orders to follow and which orders not to follow?
I'd like to state one thing. Aaron Watada is not refusing the deployment on the grounds of that he is a conscientious objector. He's not a conscientious objector. He's not against war, where Mr. Jashinsky is, but he's against this particular war as being an illegal war, and I feel he's right.
All right, well, let's get Bill's response. How would you respond to the person who said, look, you can't have a military if people are going to simply declare that I don't like this war, I don't like these orders, I'm not going to follow them? How would you respond to those people?
Well, I would say just look at what's happened with this war. Look at all the shady deals that come out of it. Look at all the... There's just too many things about it that just don't seem right.
I think you're absolutely right. For the very, very initial thing that brought us into this war, how did we get into the war? The American people didn't want to go to war. And yet, if you read the writings of Zygmunt Brzezinski in his book, you know, the Grand Chessboard.
Yes.
And he basically said there's going to have to be an incident to get the American people to be willing to go along with going to war. And then, of course, if you read the writings of the Project the New American Century, it's up there on the website, Rebuilding America's Defenses, they said we're going to have to have another incident like another Pearl Harbor. And we know that within 3 weeks of the attack on the World Trade Center, we had troops deployed in Afghanistan. That's by October 7th. So how could you possibly get troops deployed that quickly? I mean, not only were there troops there on the ground, boots on the ground in Afghanistan within 3 weeks, there were two carrier groups there. There were 40,000 troops in the surrounding area ready to move into Afghanistan. It's almost as if it was all planned ahead of time. And how could they possibly have it planned ahead of time? Unless, of course, they knew there was going to be something that was going to get the American people willing to go to war. And if that is the case, then all of this is criminal. Everything going on, and every person who's died has died unnecessarily. I agree with you, Bill. I think that this man has a lot of courage. I wish we had more people with his courage.
Oh, yes.
So do I.
Anything else, Bill?
No, that's it. I just wanted to make my opinion known.
All right. It's getting pretty late back there in Syracuse, isn't it?
It's 1:45 in the morning.
Okay,
here.
Fine. Tell me.
Are you familiar with the Zogby poll?
No.
I've heard of it.
Okay. Jim Zogby is one of the most respected pollsters in the world, but under Bush, he's rarely considered or represented. And he's got a poll now. I find the results are a revelation here. U.S. troops in Iraq, they took a poll of U.S. troops, and 72% say end the war this year in 2006. 72%. And that's the Lemoyne College Zogby poll, and it shows just 1 in 5 troops want to heed Bush's call to stay as long as they are needed. While 58% say the mission is clear, 42% say U.S. role is hazy. Plurality believes Iraqi insurgents are mostly homegrown. Almost 90% think that war is retaliation for Saddam's role in 9/11. Most do not blame Iraq public for the insurgent attacks. Now, the majority of troops oppose the use of harsh prisoner interrogation. The plurality of troops are pleased with their armor and equipment. This is the Zoghbi poll on military people over there. An overwhelming majority of 72% of American troops serving in Iraq thinks that the U.S. should exit the country within the next year, and nearly one in four say the troops should leave immediately. And that's what the new Lemoyne College Zoghbi International Survey shows.
Now, that's a very interesting and very insightful thing. The tragedy is, of course, you saw what happened in Congress this last week. Certainly, that John Murtha, who started out supporting the war, a Democrat, supported the war. He was a Marine, retired Marine colonel. Since he saw what was going on at the military hospitals, and many of the generals came to him and off the record would tell him that they can't, when they're in the military service, speak out against what the government's doing, but they could go to Congressman Murtha and tell him what was happening and the disaster we were in, and this is going to destroy our military. But when Congressman Murtha had the courage to reverse his position and say, "I was wrong, we've got to get out," he's been called senile. He's been insulted, saying unfit to ever wear a Marine uniform. He's been demonized. He's been attacked. And there's an organized effort to destroy his reputation in America.
This is a good man, Congressman Murtha. We should have more people like Congressman Murtha in Congress and less like the rest of them.
Amen to that. Anything else you want to say, Bill, before we let you go?
I will make one other point. I mean, for not for you guys, but for some of the listeners out there that might feel differently about it, that think when American troops get killed over there, that Iraqis deserve whatever happens to them in retaliation. Well, suppose a hypothetical situation. The same thing happened here in this country, and we attacked the invaders, and then the invaders took reprisals against us. How would we feel?
Exactly. These people are defending their homes.
That's been invaded.
They're defending their homes. In the beginning, I used to get angry when I heard about this. I said, "God damn, remember with their roadside bombs? They're defending their homes. They're doing the best they can, considering."
Well, of course, if we really wanted to solve the problem, what we would do would be divide the country into three sections. You see, it was artificially put together after the First World War by Winston Churchill, intentionally to create a nation that would be divided, where there'd always be conflict, so that they would need a master, and that was to be Great Britain. Well, of course, we've always kept a strong man there. You had to have it because you've got three separate areas. You got the Kurds, the Shias, and the Sunnis, and of course we used to have Christians there. Since we came to liberate the country, most of the Christians have fled because they know, of course, they have no future in Iraq, where they've lived for centuries, and we drove them all out. I think there were only 3% of the original 10% there. But if they divided into a Kurdish area, maybe even an enclave for Christians, then into a Shia and a Sunni area, this is the only way you're ever going to have peace there, and that's the last thing they ever want to do. They do not want to do what's logical. They do not want to solve the problem. They want to keep our boys there, and that is what's so unconscionable. There really are people who are unconcerned about all the boys who are dying. Oh, they may wring their hands and say how concerned they are, but they're really not.
Well, this is the dream of empire that we have. We have a dream of empire, and that's why we're there. We're there for the business. We're there for the oil. We're there to exploit this country for as much as we can. And I think the British found out what empire was all about when the Indians under Gandhi stood up to them and got the British out of that country without having a war. I think it showed the British something, and maybe we've got to be shown the same thing.
Well, I certainly hope not. I hope the good American people will speak out against this war, but they'll understand that what we're seeing in Iraq today is part of a much larger picture, and anybody would like to understand what's really going on, they need to get my talk with the syllabus, with all the documentation in it, Iraq, the Untold Story. Bill, thank you so very much for calling, and God bless you. And Ernst, are you listening shortwave internet, or are you listening on one of our big stations up there?
No, I'm listening on shortwave.
Okay, God bless. Thanks so much.
You too.
Okay.
Good night.
Okay, well, that was Bill calling from Syracuse, and if you're out there and would like to give us a call, again, 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. We've got time for just one more call. Well, certainly you opened a can of worms, Arthur, but I think it's an important can of worms. I think we need to talk about the war. We need to talk about the fact that we were lied to. Not
we
only
have
about
to.
That.
We have to put an end to the insanity, Dr. Right. Stan. This is insanity.
Well, if we do not, of course, put an end to insanity very soon, I fear the insanity is going to put an end to America.
Yes, you're right.
And, of course, there is a history of great nations is that they all destroy themselves. They all committed suicide. And as certainly as Abraham Lincoln said so well, at what point should we expect the approach of danger? By what means should we fortify ourselves against it? Should we expect some transatlantic giant to step the ocean and crush us with a blow? Never. All the armies of Europe, Asia, and Africa combined could never make a mark on the Blue Ridge or take a drink from the Ohio. Then at what point should danger be expected? And I answer, if it ever reaches, it will spring up among us. It can never come from abroad.
Dr. Stan, it's a rare privilege to work with you and be on with you.
Well, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program, Arthur.
Okay, again, I'm Arthur Bernclough. I'm with Veterans for Constitutional Law Limited. I'm a veterans advocate. We try to help veterans with their cases. Right now, we have an assault upon veterans with the Veterans Disability Commission. There's an all-out assault against veterans benefits by, I will call them the lunatic fringe in Congress, but more and more people are believing that the lunatic fringe in Congress is this current administration. And if we don't do something about the kind of thinking that's going on here, as veterans, you're not going to see too many people going into the service in the future. As it is, enlistments are down. And enlistments are down not only because of the war. Enlistments are down because people are getting privy to the fact that once you become a veteran, you're going to get abused, you're going to be done out of your veterans' benefits, and your reason for going in to serve your country initially was patriotic, but the country is paying you back by giving you veterans' benefits in case you're injured, by sending you to school on the GI Bill, and people are not going to have the incentive to go back into the service anymore as they're finding out about how veterans are being treated. And it's a very bad thing what's going on. They have something called the 4% solution, the VA. In other words, actually only 4% of the people who are applying for these benefits are really going to get them. The agenda is to deny. And they're spending an awful lot of money to save an awful lot of money. And any of you veterans out there are having problems with the VA, having problems with the Department of Defense, you want to talk about it, I'm here for that reason. I could easily be reached at 631-474-4261. My telephone is tapped. The government does not like me talking to veterans. But until they cut me off the phone entirely, I'll be here and I'll be trying to help veterans. And that's what we were created for, to help veterans.
Well, Arthur, I appreciate the work you do for the veterans. I appreciate the fact that you do this without compensation. You do this because you really care about them. And if we had more people like you, all across America, we would not have the problems. And the veterans would certainly be taken care of. I'm all in favor of saving money, but not off the backs of the young men, the idealistic young men who've gone off to overseas to fight for freedom. And, of course, maybe we're losing it at home, but that's not their fault. They deserve his right. They deserve to be taken care of. Good night. God bless you.
Good night, Dr. Stan, and thank you again.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course this is the time I need to remind our listeners out there that Radio Liberty is primarily listener supported, and we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters. And of course, if you are in an area with fluoridated water, one of the things that you can do is get a Berkey unit, either a Big Berkey or Berkey Light, with the special filters, the PF2 or PF4 fluoride filters. You do not want to be drinking fluoridated water. And, of course, we do carry the Miracle 2 soap and the Sanjian shortwave radio and the Robinson homeschool curriculum. And now we're carrying some healthcare products, too. But all of this, of course, goes to help us do what we do 5 hours a day so that we can get the information out across America. So if you agree with me that they have some very, very real problems, if you would like to help us as we reach out, try to educate the American people about the spiritual forces which are energizing what's going on, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like a free copy of our latest newsletter, and I hate to say it, it's a made newsletter, it's going to be going out here and probably the first of the week, and it will give you some very real important thoughts on the immigration problem and why the President of the United States had steadfastly refused to implement the laws which he is says sworn to uphold, the laws of our land. He's refused to implement them. He's refused to close down the borders, to stop the catch and release program, to go after the employers who are hiring illegal immigrants. He's refused to enforce the laws of our land. And you have to ask why. Well, after you read this newsletter, you'll understand why. I think it has a tremendous message in it. If you'd like a free copy of our main newsletter, we'll be glad to send you one. If you call us at 1-800-544-8927, 1-800-544-8927. If you listen to our last hour program and you don't have a copy of the Earth Charter, would like one, we'd be glad to send it to you. But you can get these things on the Internet. You can get the Earth Charter. Just go to our website. Or I believe we have it posted there. If not, you can certainly get it anywhere on the Internet. The Earth Charter, which is stored in the Ark of Hope, the Luciferian counterpart of the Ark of the Covenant. And then, of course, our newsletter, the main newsletter, will be published published on my website probably within the next week or so. And then, of course, we do hope that you'll tell others about our programs and encourage them to listen, because that's how we're getting the information out. And feel free to copy any of our videos or tapes or four tape sets and get that information out as well. And if you can get people to listen to our programs, they may start out really thinking that we're really way off base. I had a very nice lady from back in upstate New York who called me just a few days ago to tell me that she listened for 6 months before she finally realized that what we were saying was true. And now she goes around trying to tell people what's going on, and everybody thinks she's crazy. Well, of course, she's not crazy. She just understands what's really happening. And our job is to get you educated so you can educate others. Because it's far more than philosophical or ideological or cultural. We're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. And the media is controlled, and there is a conspiracy against Christianity. And of course, we're going from war to war to war. And we're moving into very, very difficult times, difficult financial times, difficult times as far as immigration is concerned. I really believe that we're going to see a conscious, organized effort to destroy the middle class in this country. And we'll soon have, what they have in so many other countries, a small group of very wealthy people and then everybody else impoverished. So certainly if you've not yet seen our talk on the financial tsunami, or got our DVD or video that goes with that, you really need to get the information. You need to begin to make preparations for the very difficult times that lie ahead. And then, of course, our talk on the world revolution, explaining to you how we brought Fidel Castro to power. There's so much information you can get from our newsletters. And, of course, if you need the documentation, we'll be glad to provide it. Again, our number 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, RadioLiberty.com. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Because if this country doesn't turn back to God, we will never again have His blessing. And lastly, please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection.